You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. Now, this podcast is all about navigating the changing shopping habits of consumers post-COVID-19. Now, the introduction of lockdown in the UK was a catalyst for change in consumer behavior, with panic buying and stockpiling of everyday essentials, and consumers had to adjust to a new way of shopping. It's tricky stuff for the food industry to deal with, but online grocery has seen a boom, and the traditional big shop has come back, as seen by the significant reduction in weekly transactions. But what else? And how would I make my millions in the post-coronavirus world? Let's discover what's in store. We're joined by Liz Richardson, Managing Director at Hey Human.
Hello.
Kate Fleetstra, Global Food and Drink Analyst at Mintel.
Hello.
And Chris Malloy, co-founder of Brand Potential.
Hi.
So, Kate, we all know that there's been a vast change in human life over the last couple of months. What's happened, and what have been the change in shopping habits that you can see?
Well, it's been a really interesting time, I think we can all agree. And we're absolutely seeing some really interesting changes. One of the big areas that you've already touched on is the fact that a huge number of shoppers are actually engaging more with online shopping. We're seeing a lot more people go into home cooking, so really taking that restaurant experience in home and actually developing more of an ability to scratch cook. We're also seeing a real interest in health and immunity, and I think that's really paramount to the outbreak. And as part of that, we're seeing a real interest as well in the move to veganism. But aside from all of that, it's not just about health. We also know that consumers are still involved in looking at products that give them some sort of indulgence. And that's something to be really mindful of as well at this time.
And can you put any numbers to this for us? Have you analysed the data on this yet, or is it a little bit too early?
No, absolutely. So we've been kind of tracking what consumers have been doing over the last few weeks, and we've got some great numbers. So we know, for example, 1 in 5 are shopping online more. And we know that I mentioned the vegan diet has been seen to be a little bit more appealing. And we know that, you know, 1 in 10 consumers said that the outbreak has made the vegan diet more appealing. And that actually rises to almost a quarter of 16 to 24s. And this is the sort of demographic that we're already really excited about veganism. But what we're seeing is that the outbreak really has the potential to accelerate that.
Okay, now Liz, let's start looking at some specifics here. What effect has this had on different brands and how they work? Have some been more successful than others, do you think?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think one of the things I would just say is that I think we have to be a little bit careful when we talk about brands sort of capitalising on this opportunity, because I think I certainly, you know, obviously this crisis, I think brands have actually got a role to play in actually helping support people through the crisis. And I think what we have seen, actually, the brands that have been more successful are the brands that have really leveraged their brand purpose and haven't profited from it.
And sorry, what do you mean by helping people through? Can you give some more specifics?
Well, I think the fact is that we've seen a lot of, you know, people are going through a lot of uncertainty and a lot of change, and there's a lot of fear. So what we've actually seen is that certainly from a communications point of view, brands have been able to adapt their communication. So, for example, if you think about the retailers as a whole, what they've been managed to do is actually sort of start to position themselves more as an institution and a pillar of the community. They've been able to showcase their workers and, you know, the role that they've actually taken in making sure that their shelves have been stocked. We've also seen, you know, some of the actually more of the heritage brands, people like Bird's Eye, for example, who have actually experienced significant growth. And what they've done is they've really tapped into that insight from a consumer point of view of actually the challenge that people have at dinner time. You've been all locked together, and actually one of the big challenges you have is you know, what's for tea tonight? And actually they've tapped into that with a great campaign, which actually exactly asks that question. So I think the brands that have been able to be, who have communicated effectively through this period are the brands that have been able to do it in a relevant way.
That's really interesting. So I mean, you're talking about a relatively, well-established, almost old-fashioned brand there. And is it the well-known names that people have sort of, you know, run away to rather than trying out new things, or are people still experimenting?
I think we have seen that people have leant back into, again, because we've been through, you know, going through a change of uncertainty. I think some consumers have actually leant back into the brands that they know and that they feel comfortable with.
Comfort eating, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's not to say, I think also we also have had a lot of time on our hands. And, you know, as a result, then yes, people potentially have experimented as well. So I think it's both. But I think the key thing is that, you know, it's for brands to do it in a relevant way for consumers during this period of time. You know, it's making sure that people have tapped into, the mood of the nation. And I think that's the key thing.
Yeah. OK, Chris, let's talk about cash, because a lot of your work is with private equity companies. Again, this relatively early in terms of how the industry moves, this is relatively early days. But has this changed values? Has it changed the investment landscape in food and drink?
I mean, that's a good question. I think when we went, I think the sands are shifting as we go through this, as they are for brand owners anyway, not just private equity. I think as we went into this, I read somewhere that 90% of global private equity deals were temporarily at least put on hold as investors sought to shore up their portfolio companies and working through logistical and operational issues in relation to the businesses that they currently own. But equally, where there's funds that have been raised within private equity, I think I read as well the other day, $1.6 trillion worth of funds are yet to be invested. And that's where the investors have a mandate to invest and seek a return within a timeline. So, you know, we know from some of our clients that the sands have shifted from initially battening down the hatches on deals to very quickly turning their sights on the deals. And I think, you know, it's widely regarded as potentially being a buyer's market. And as I say, there's significant funds that need to be invested. So I think, they'll still be looking for the rising stars of categories, but equally they'll also be looking for brands that might be somewhat distressed. And as I say, it might be a buyer's market and they can negotiate accordingly. And I think that's a good question about how deals will be structured, because obviously 2020 is going to be a challenging time financially for many businesses, regardless of the sector, and obviously historically deals are structured based on your last trading period. So I think there's probably going to be a little bit more creativity behind how deals are structured, because as I say, that activity will start to pick up again soon. And I know that there's, you know, predictions in certain sectors that deals will come back onto the table.
So Chris, do you think that it's a bit of a bottleneck at the moment? You know, is there, it's just, have things just slowed and there will be a huge amount of activity as soon as the taps turn back on again?
I think it will come back fairly slowly. I think investors are looking for at least a degree of certainty. I know some that we talked on a daily basis are chomping at the bit, so to speak, but equally, the investment is driven by certainty and confidence. So I think, you know, everything is unknown at the moment. Certainly the mid and long to long term is unknown. There's issues around liquidity in relation to some of their portfolio businesses. So, you know, I know that's going to probably slow down some investors. So I think we'll see a slowly easing of the tap, actually. I don't think there'll be, the V-shaped return to deals that we might otherwise see.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I think let's go to Kate here. What are you mentioned a couple of sort of different consumer behaviours, sort of cooking at home and things like that. What do you think the other important changes are that have come about by lockdown? And how can brands capitalise on this?
So I think one of the interesting points that we're seeing is the kind of interest in eating healthily. So we're seeing that a lot more people are kind of eating healthily, doing more exercise. We know, for example, that a third of people are actually eating more fruit and vegetables since the start of the outbreak. And that's really with a view to sort of supporting the immune system. There's definitely a lot of talk in the industry about what brands should do to respond to this. And absolutely, there's some great products on the market that have been launched this year. So, for example, Special K Immune Support, a big brand, obviously, with immune kind of written on the packaging. And these are fantantastic examples that will no doubt be really interesting to consumers.
Do we know if they've been particularly successful during this yet, or is it a bit early?
I think it's a little bit early. I mean, everything is changing so quickly at the moment, and so I don't have that data to hand.
Yeah, yeah.
What I would say about immune boosting foods is that whilst there's a lot of speculation around the interest in them among consumers, if you look at Google Trends, you can also see that over the last 12 months, the term immune boosting foods experienced a huge peak right at the start of the lockdown in the UK. But since that point, it's come right back down. So whilst there's a lot of talk and speculation about this interest in immunity, actually what we do need to consider is that consumers will continue behaving as they have done before. So there are
fickle little beasts. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. But you know, the kind of priorities that consumers had before lockdown are still there. And yes, some of those trends may be accelerated. Like I mentioned, veganism before. We do believe that interest in veganism is accelerating. Sustainability equally. You know, I think we're seeing that slightly less of a priority, but that's not going to go anywhere. And brands really need to be mindful of this in looking at NPD opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Chris, health and well-being have been huge trends recently. And obviously, it makes sense that that's connected to the immune system and COVID immunity and things like that. Have you seen a lot of people doing a lot of work in this area? And does this translate into actual activity?
What I should say is just comment on the role of innovation. I think first of all, if I can, in relation to the times we're in. You know, what we see within terms of innovation is that there's a cyclical nature to it, and in previous downturns and recessions, clients have tended to invest less in new products and services and long-term innovation and retrench back to maintain their core and renovate around their core. So I think this is a debate that we're having with our clients at the moment, and a lot of them are still grappling with this. So yes, there's still going to be an opportunity for launching new products. Kate, you've just mentioned one, and there's been some recent launches where clients have launched during this period, and rather than push it back until we're through this in some way. But I think what we'll see is a different approach to innovation. So it might not be about launching new products and services, because we know that's inherently challenging. And I don't think it's widely regarded that around about 80%, if not more, Kate, you might have this statistic, of new launches actually fail. But what we help our clients with is how they approach innovation more broadly. And it might not be new launches. It might be renovating around their core. It might be rationalizing their core. It could be acquiring new brands, and helping to develop a more innovative thinking around their portfolios, not necessarily just launch new products and services. Because I think one of the things we're finding is, of course, you know, a lot of brands in good times allow their ranges and portfolios to become quite bloated. So I think this is the time where we'll see businesses, and we're helping with a couple at the moment with, okay, you know, what are our core assets? What are the core ranges?
Yeah.
And how do we organize our brands in the portfolio, but also using it as an opportunity to either rationalize their range or in some cases divest of certain brands.
Yeah. So Liz, Chris is talking about lots of changes and changes to lines. Which of the retail trends do you think are going to stick? You know, are we talking online as being a big thing? You know, the single big shop, cooking sourdough. What do you reckon is going to stick around in 6 months' time?
I think as we've all been saying, what we've seen is, you know, a real acceleration of people now shopping online. You know, there are people who were very reluctant to use online shopping and e-commerce, and now they've been forced to do it and they've experienced it. And they've seen that actually it's not as bad as they thought it was going to be. So I think certainly that is going to be a trend that continues. I think the other sort of trend that we're seeing coming through, which I think will continue, is actually the fear of actually connecting with people away from the home. If you look at China, for example, we're seeing, you know, that 65% of people there are now shopping closer to home than they were, and 53%. Then they're also starting to avoid shopping centres because actually there's a fear of coming into contact with strangers. So I think one of the other things that we may see is that perhaps there's more of a focus on, you know, local stores, independent stores as well, where people are, you know, shopping closer to home and using their online to do their sort of major shops.
Which I can completely concur with. I think we're hearing quite a lot about a potential renaissance in smaller high streets and local shopping. I think the key thing is that in times like this, we often read so much about how everything is going to change fundamentally: the world, consumers, society, attitudes, behaviours, everything. And a lot will shift. But underlying all of this is we have the same human needs. We have the same needs within any given category. We have the same need to shop. So I don't think that changes. And therefore, the principles around building brands, a lot of them will remain the same. I think how we then choose to exercise and deliver against those needs, that might shift. So, for example, as Liz was saying, we might choose to shop locally. We might choose to exercise online. We might not choose to renew our gym membership. Mm. But we have the same underlying needs that drive us and shape the choices we make. So I think, you know, where we will see fundamental shifts, you know, if you think about the last recession in 2008, again, when we were in the thick of that, we read so much about everything was going to change. And there were fundamental shifts. So, for example, you know, the role of own label, and we all became savvy shoppers. But I think there's certain behaviours, I think, that we've obviously had to compromise, that a lot of people will just be aspiring to embrace again, albeit with some caveats in the short to midterm whilst this is around. So, you know, many of us can't wait to get down to the pub again. And yes, in the short to midterm, there's going to be some new behaviours around that. But in the long term, we're sociable creatures. You know, we like the comfort and security derived from interacting closely with others. And I think there, you know, that's where we're seeing a trend. But I think long-term behaviours will hopefully shape that the on-trade, whilst it's going to be tough during the recessionary times for the next few years, will stand the test of time beyond that.
And I completely agree with that, because I think your point is that we're human beings. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we all crave that face-to-face interaction, human interaction. And I think that's the piece that everybody's been missing. But I think the key thing is it's when somebody has discovered something which has actually improved their lifestyle in some way, whether that is the fact that now they've got more time because they're not spending it going around the shops to do their big shop. I think that's what there could be, you know, those sorts of behaviours are ones that we're likely to see remain.
Kate, I'm interested in this idea of the resurgence of the high street. I think there are a huge amount of different factors that could be involved in this. You know, if there's going to be a rent crash, then could it make the high street more appealing to new businesses? Presumably, if the high street does have a resurgence, it will be a very different place, and it'll be hopefully set up for longevity. Do you think this is realistic?
Very good question. And I think, even before COVID-19, the high street was something that has been hugely discussed over recent years. Mm. I think there is potential for change here. I mean, as Liz and Chris, have quite rightly said, the amount of change we're likely to see isn't going to be astronomical. But I think the level of ingenuity we're seeing from brands could show the kind of activation that could happen on the high street. And what I mean by that is the kind of agility of brands to respond to the virus and in delivering things like experiences at home. And with that kind of inventive mindset, you could imagine that brands could actually bring this approach to the high street. As we've heard, a lot more people are doing online shopping. We know that 1 in 10 are actually using click and collect more, for example. So could there be more opportunities for that style of shopping on the high street? And we're also using this time, as I mentioned, to engage in experiences. And there's been some fantastic brand kind of collaborations popping up over the last few weeks. For example, the Haagen-Dazs collaboration with the cinema group Secret Cinema. So that's where movie fans can take part in Secret Sofa and watch a film every week, and they get a discount on a specific flavour of Haagen-Dazs. Mm. And you've also got experiences that really kind of bring the consumer experience home. And again, that's something that I think brands and retailers could really leverage more in the future. There's a great example, and I love the name, called Homage to Fromage, and they do all-you-can-eat cheese parties. And what they've been doing over the last few weeks is create an at-home cheese party box, and you get portions of cheese, chutney, crackers, and a bit of game to sort of take you through that tasting. Now, as you say, Liz, we're all social creatures, and I'm sure once this is over, we're not going to all want to sit at home on our own and do these parties over Zoom. But is there more of an opportunity for brands to tap into this sort of indulgent, exciting element and create this kind of proposition in the retailers?
I find this area absolutely fascinating. Now, Liz, we're talking about scratch cooking, experiences at home, people baking. I know we like to talk about these things as being trends. Is it really, or is it just a bunch of people on Instagram posting pictures of their sourdough? And I'm to blame as much as anyone, but I'm connected with my food probably in a way that most people aren't. Does that really make anything more than a trend? Is this possibly a fundamental shift, or is it just a blip?
This crisis has also driven a sort of sense of new resourcefulness. Because I think that's the opportunity that brands can actually tap into. And I think there is an opportunity for brands to give people the tools to be self-sufficient. So like you say, there's places giving your recipe for how to make your sourdough. And in some ways, and I think that is personally from my point of view, I actually think that is a great trend, being able to give an in-home experience. Because at the end of the day, for any marketing communication to be effective, it needs to be memorable. Now, if you're up close and personal and you're creating your own experience in your home, then that's going to be memorable. And therefore, if it's going to be memorable, then it's going to be able to deliver some sort of behaviour change for that consumer, and obviously, hopefully, then lead them to actually go on and purchase that product.
But are these fundamental changes that will last, or is it just a few Instagram pictures?
I mean, to be honest, the whole idea of sort of in-home experiences have been around for a while. I think it's definitely, you know, it's been accelerated over this period of time. So, I mean, personally, I think that, I mean, certainly I've been talking to my clients about in-home experiences, and I'm about to talk to one tomorrow, in fact, and it's something that I would continue to encourage. So yes, I think, you know, as you said earlier, I think at the end of the day, it's a bit like going to the pub. People are going to want to also have those live experiences, you know, away from the home. But I think there is going to be a role for both.
If I can add in there as well, we know from our consumer data that over a third of consumers are already cooking more from scratch, and it's younger people that are actually driving that as well. We also ask our consumers how many are planning to cook from scratch more after the outbreak and once they get back to sort of normality. And that's actually over half, closer to two thirds among the 16 to 34s. Now, obviously, we all know we have brilliant intentions for how we're going to live our lives after this. But I think that kind of intention taps in exactly to what you're saying, Liz, that this is something that is actually really resonating with consumers. And I think brands can help facilitate this cooking at home more, particularly as not everyone actually has more time and not everyone has cooking skills. So yes, lots of people have additional time at the moment, but a lot of people don't. So brands can actually provide more convenience and education in this kind of area.
So I think this is a sort of $64,000 question. Is something a blip or a trend, and is it a short-term trend or a longer-term trend? And, you know, the honest answer is much of this we don't know. The way we think about this is to think about underlying values that we have or beliefs that we have at a kind of cultural level. So, you know, if we take, let's take our leisure time at home. You know, are our values and belief systems around how we spend our leisure time at home shifting because of this? Do we believe something differently? Do we believe that, you know, spending more time at home, maybe it's for some people at a slower pace, slightly more inner sort of directed in terms of our sort of relationship with the world around us? You know, I think there seems to be enough evidence to suggest that as a value might be shifting. So therefore, you know, from that, we could probably conclude that, you know, many of our behaviours now might be sort of born out after this. Whereas if you contrast that with, let's take our attitudes, our values around social time as opposed to sort of leisure time. So, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, I think those values are so intrinsic to how we sort of believe that I'm not sure they will shift. So I think, you know, will we Zoom on a Friday with friends when we could otherwise be down the pub? Probably not, actually. I think we'd much rather be sitting around a table with them, even if there's restrictions around that in the next 18 months, than we would on a Zoom call. So, you know, therefore brands in that space, so let's take, you know, beverage brands in the on-trade versus the off-trade, they're having to think about how they adapt quite quickly in the short term. So, you know, only this morning I had a brew dog appear on my Instagram offering me a direct-to-consumer model at home. But, you know, that's an area where I think our behaviours probably won't last, actually. So it kind of, I think that's the way we would think about it. We'd go back to thinking about, okay, what's the belief system around something? What are our values? Are they shifting or not? Because we can't 100% say that then our behaviours now are going to carry on. But if our values are changing, then our behaviours might change.
Yeah. Okay. But let's just shift this onto a slightly different level now. Liz, we're looking at a different sort of level of marketing creativity here, where theoretically you don't need to spend millions of pounds on TV ads. Do you think we're going through a huge sort of period of change now? Have we seen companies being more agile and using their marketing in a very different way, using social media, and you know, has the coronavirus crisis shown that to be the case, or has it actually shown weaknesses in that approach?
I think yes, we have. I think obviously the rise of social media has increased significantly over the over this period. And yes, we have seen a lot of brands adapt their advertising to make sure that it is relevant for the current crisis. And we've also seen ads being developed in, you know, quite cost effectively and in a limited amount of time. And, you know, as I said earlier, it is, we've seen the ads that, that have reflected the mood of the nation being the most effective, the most, the ones that are connecting most with consumers.
Can you be specific? Any
well,
examples?
I mean, again, I mean, I think the retailer ads that I mentioned earlier. So, you know, a lot of the retailers, the likes of the Morrisons ads, the Marks and Spencers ads, those ads have been found to be highly effective for them in terms of, you know, people's recall of them. And I think, you know, as I said before, I mean, the Bird's Eye campaign, the What's for Tea, and the McCain, where they've really sort of been able to adapt their communication to make sure that it is relevant to this particular period of time. Do I think that it's going to be ongoing? I mean, I think the key thing is I think, yes, there's an opportunity to create agile creativity. And, you know, there's going to be a need, I think, certainly is, you know, the purse strings obviously tightening over the next few years. However, I think the key thing, it goes back to what I said before, it's about relevance. You know, what we need to do is make sure that any content or any communication that is being developed is relevant for the consumers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just to build on that, actually, I don't know if you've seen there's a Maltesers ad that has been quite well received recently, because I think what it does really well is four women on a Zoom call talking about one of them going on a virtual date. And it's obviously very lighthearted. And they're all obviously consuming Maltesers. And I think what's really nice about that one is the brand is staying true to its core and its positioning around mindless grazing. So it's not compromised that at all. The usage occasion, it's people interacting socially, it's not compromised that at all. It's a sharing moment. And actually, but what it's done is the execution is very sensitive towards what's going on at the moment. So, you know, I think we've seen a shift in the last few weeks from brands that are just, you know, very generically talking about COVID and how they're reacting to a brand like Maltesers adapting really well, because, as I say, the context is very relevant and sensitive, but the message is true to its
okay.
core.
Now, we're going to have to wind this up, and I've got a question that I'd like to ask each of you in turn. And that is, I'm going to pose a situation. You each have £1 million to invest in either a brand or a food type or a bit of technology to make some kind of advantage for yourself in the post coronavirus world. How would you invest it? Where would you put your dosh? I think, Kate, let's start with you. You've got £1 million. Where would you put it?
Well, I think my £1 million would go into further investment within plant-based. I think there's been such a huge surge in interest in plant-based food products over the last few years. And we've only seen this increase as a result of the outbreak. So I think from a health point of view, and when we are starting to think more about the environment again, from a sustainability point of view, plant-based is really where investment needs to be going to meet the consumer needs of the future.
Okay, fantastic. Liz, where would you put your million?
I would probably put it into a direct-to-consumer model, because I think actually one of the things, and I, you know, that's why I asked if it needed to be in a particular category. For me, direct-to-consumer is going to be a key channel for brands, because I think, you know, I think it's, well, we don't know, but the media would suggest it's likely that this won't be the first type of experience that we have of being in lockdown. So I would look to invest in something that could be COVID proof.
Oh, I'm loving your work there. Okay. And Chris, where are you going to invest your million?
Liz, that's exactly what I was going to say. So I would invest in a direct-to-consumer model that's plant-based. There you go.
Love it.
But the best of all three worlds.
That's what I mean. Seriously, that is it's regarded that the tech sector and tech-enabled businesses will lead the charge in the return to growth of the investment private equity sector, actually. So I would, aside from those models, I would invest in health tech, I think, as a growth sector. And I know that's an increasingly attractive sector for investors. So
very good. Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us. We'll look forward to finding out how your £1 million, actually fared in the post-COVID-19 world. And we look forward to catching up with the future and see how all of these things are evolving. Anyway, you've been listening to the Table Talk podcast from Food Matters with Liz Richardson, Kate Fleetstra, Chris Malloy, and me, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to vegetable picking robots. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.